Dow. I represent the appellant, Mrs. Ross, in this case. Before I get into the issues, though, I would like to briefly go out and highlight certain of facts in the background of this case. This was a two-day equitable distribution trial, December 6th and 7th. It involved a 22-year marriage. Mrs. Ross, the testimony, I think, was unrebutted that she hadn't worked outside the marriage since 1997, that she had previously worked back prior to 1997 in the Marine Corps. She had graduated law school. She'd been the primary caretaker of two children since 1997. In 2013, 14, and 15, she suffered serious back injuries. One fell off a ladder and the other one was a car accident. She was being treated at the time of the trial by Dr. John Peters. She had been diagnosed with post-concussive syndrome with mild traumatic brain injury with cognitive impairment. Also, significant facts were that Mr. Ross was at that time employed by IBM, earning $267,000.
Mr. McDowell, the time here goes very quickly,
yes.
And we're very familiar with the facts. I wonder if you would explain to us why you don't think that the trial court's written findings were sufficient to justify the defined duration award.
All right, Your Honor, thank you. Specifically, in the court's letter opinion dated February 17th, under Factor 9, I will read. The court said, Mrs. Ross's current physical and cognitive disabilities prevent her from working as an attorney at this time. So the court made that specific finding. That was the majority of the trial, was devoted to whether or not she was capable of working, whether or not she really had this disability. And then the court goes on to say, Mr. Ross's evidence was insufficient to show any jobs other than as an attorney or any salary potential for Mrs. Ross. She then goes on to say that she believes Mrs. Ross is capable of re-entering the workforce within 12 to 18 months, stating that she's very intelligent and articulate and she should be able to find gainful employment. However, in the next sentence, she says, given that there is no credible evidence as to other employment, the court is unable to impute income. Evidence was, she also says, evidence was presented that her injury may resolve shortly. So if you look at those findings, Your Honor, what you see is basically a very schizophrenic position. The court has said she's disabled right now, and the court knows you're supposed to look and evaluate the situation as it is on the ground at the time of the hearing. And then there's really no other evidence in the record that would suggest that she may resolve. This is purely speculative, purely conjecture. The only thing that even comes close to this is that there was some evidence elicited by on cross-examination of my expert, Dr. Peters, in which he said that most people with post-concussive syndrome would resolve in 12 to 18 months, but there's another 10% that don't. And then he went on to say, but Mrs. Ross is in that other 10%. And that gets to that other issue, because I was about to ask, or I did ask, what does that mean for Mrs. Ross? And he said that it'll be permanent, or could be permanent. So here's what, that's as close as you get to the evidence. The court said, really, in response to the motion to reconsider, this is what the court said in the March 21st letter opinion. She said she was responding to the motion to reconsider. She had reviewed the motion and was making the following rulings. She said, with respect to spousal support, the court's considered all the statutory factors, Mrs. Ross's ability to pay and Mr. Ross's needs, and therefore she awards, and goes on to restate the award as 5 years with 5 years defined duration with 11 years reservation. Then the court says this, as the court stated in its opinion letter dated February 17, 2017, defendant presented no evidence that plaintiff could find employment other than as an attorney. And that, however, the court found plaintiff to be very intelligent, articulate, and capable. Now, I understand that there's great deference given to the trial court and whether or not the judge is there to observe the witnesses and hear the evidence directly, but that is, it seems to me, she makes her own decisions there and then kind of contradicts him. Simply to say that this is an intelligent and articulate woman when she said she's disabled.
Well, was that soliloquy by the trial court sufficient to meet the requirements of the statute that requires a written determination to support defined duration? And if not, why not?
It isn't because it gives no logical basis, no factual basis, that would lead you to conclude that within a period of 5 years, A, that this woman is going to be back to employability, or even if she is back to employability in 5 years, she's already said we don't know what amount of income she can generate. Even now, as it was before the court said, defendant failed to give me any evidence on what her employability or what kind of salary level she could have. So how is the court going to divine just by saying she's articulate, she's intelligent, I think she's capable of reentering the workforce, and then this malady that she suffers from, which could be permanent, as Dr. Peters said, could suddenly or may result, her words were may resolve in the future. Now that, to me, Your Honor, I mean, she should have had some kind of, she should have pointed to something in the evidence, in the record, and said, because of this, I believe that that justifies that she will be able to find employment. The record was completely empty of anything that would say what would happen to her in the future. The defendant put on Dr. Donald Hope, a neurosurgeon, who opined that my client did not suffer whatsoever from this syndrome to begin with. But obviously that doctor's opinion was not accepted by the court when the court said she is disabled, because Dr. Hope specifically said she did not have this particular condition with mild traumatic brain injury.
I want to ask you something about the assignment of error dealing with the NFCU account, I think it's referred to as.
Maybe federal.
If I'm correct, the husband opened that account on the day of separation. Is that correct?
Just about, yes, sir. May have been.
Although if the account was opened prior to actual separation, but on the day of separation, is that account marital or separate?
I would submit that it is marital.
Do we know whether he walked out first and then opened the account or vice versa?
We know that he announced his intent to depart on the same day that he opened that account. He physically departed the following weekend. But what he used that account for, Your Honor, was to put marital funds, joint marital funds from the other NFCU account into that account in anticipation of his leaving. And Judge Irby actually did find in her second opinion letter, she said implicitly that, and I think it was unrebutted by defense, that yes, he did put $44,000 of joint marital funds into the account. But the judge then went on to say it is his burden then to prove that he hasn't committed a waste or that it was for a proper purpose. She came to the conclusion that he did meet that burden, but we would submit to you that he did not. There was $3,000 put back into the account. We do agree to that. And so we'd be down to $41,000. But she mistakenly took the testimony that Mr. Ross had put $10,000 out of that $44,000 into the attorney's fees that I received as a pending litigant. In the testimony, he actually said that he testified that came out of a $15,000 IBM bonus that he received in August of 2016. We submit, Your Honor, that on that, there definitely was not the kind of evidence that Anderson and McBride and Beck have talked about. They just put a demonstrative exhibit into evidence with all his bank statements, and then
didn't the husband testify too?
He testified that the money that he used was for setting up a new house with him and his boys.
And the court accepted that testimony as true.
The court did accept that testimony, Your Honor, but without any kind of. I think in Anderson they talk about when McBride that he should be able to say this amount. We saw no checks going to his new rental. We saw no money going to purchase.
What would excuse me, what requires any evidence beyond the husband testifying, this is what I did with the money? Is there any case that says you have to, you can only prove legitimate expenses by bank statements and check records?
I thought the court, this court in McBride in 2004 sustained the trial court, Judge Gaylord Finch, when he said that that was not adequate, that, well, that simply making that statement was not adequate. So I would think implicitly.
Well, but that's where the trial court didn't believe the husband.
Yes, the trial court did not believe
the husband. Do we have any cases that have reversed because there was not any forensic evidence, any banking evidence to support the husband's testimony?
I think Anderson seems to indicate the kind of financial documentation that should support that testimony. It just can't be bare bones like they tried to present in this case.
You're into your rebuttal. You could continue or reserve as you wish.
I'll step down then and wait for Ms. Grenadier.
That's fine, thank you. Ms. Grenadier?
Yes. By way of a very quick explanation, Your Honor, we both have got this flu, but she's worse than I am, much worse, so I'm arguing with
her. Okay, I'm
seems
sorry.
Seems to be going around.
Yes, well, she's got the cough, and she can't stop coughing. So, Your Honor, I'd like to very briefly touch on the various issues that he has appealed. With regard to the duration, to begin with, I can't find a case where there's been a reservation of right to reopen. Where it's been reversed and said that it was not, in other words, reversed and it was the duration period should have been corrected. All of the courts, and I think it's Wright versus Wright, which I believe it was one of Judge Beal's cases. There's the Brewer case and the Torian case. I think my partner very abruptly and quickly put those in front of the court and appropriately.
This is on the first assignment of error?
That's the first assignment of error.
The statute 2107.3 requires written findings to support a defined duration support award, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, Your Honor, I understand that. However, if you look at what they actually appealed, if you look at his assignments of error in the amended final decree, they didn't actually appeal the fact that there were no written findings. And the Torian case says then that that is not an assignment of error. He kind of merged that because what he said was there was no evidence. That's a second prong. And they failed completely.
So you're saying it's procedurally barred?
Yes, I am. However, I just quickly to say that she did.
Well, doesn't the assignment of error, there was the trial court erred in failing to make sufficient findings to support a defined duration award.
We objected, Your Honor, because if you look at his actual assignment of error, it's different than what is on the amended final decree. In other words, I understand what he put, but if you look at the amended final decree, he didn't.
You're saying he didn't preserve the issue.
Correct.
Not that the assignment of error is insufficient.
Right. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little confused. Yes, you're absolutely correct. But certainly, I do believe that in her opinions, she put enough down in writing.
Does that comply with Cleary, our recent decision in Cleary?
The Cleary decision, Your Honor, I was briefly involved in that case. The Cleary case is totally different from this case. The Cleary case, if I recall correctly, and I don't believe it had a reservation, but the Cleary case, the facts are entirely different. This particular case, if we're talking just about the findings on the defined duration, is entirely different. In this case, I hate to say this because it's kind of an albatross for people that think because you get a five-year award with a reservation for another 6 years, if you go in that period of time after within 11 years, the award, if needed, could go on 5 years, 10 years, or more. That's why the cases that Brummer, and particularly the Wright case, which was 2013, I think is right in point here.
You're saying that this is not a defined duration award?
Not exactly. Unfortunately, our statutes, which we all know is true, they're not always written as concisely as we would like. But defined duration to me means you get 5 years and you're cut off. Because a 5-year with a reservation is not really a defined duration because you've got the right to come back in. It's almost the same as modifiable alimony. Not exactly, but certainly almost the same. I wish the statute were a little more clear, and perhaps we will do something to clear it up. But I believe under this particular case, the court found that she was now able to be gainfully employed, not as an attorney, but right now she could be gainfully employed. I would like to skip to the issue of the appellate review of the alimony awarded. Several things. To begin with, the evidence that was presented by counsel and Mrs. Ross, they put in one expense sheet. They didn't testify to anything about what her future needs would be as soon as the house was sold. The expense sheet itself, which had $7,600 in it, had $1,000 of legal fees, which would have been paid or were paid. So that's not ongoing. It had erroneous health information because she never bothered to put in what the COBRA was. She wasn't paying the taxes on the house and there wouldn't be maintenance. Furthermore, she put depreciation in for $250 a month. There was more than, actually for her car, I didn't mean a depreciation on the house. Now, if you add all this up, you're down to the 4,000s. She awarded her $5,000 a month. They didn't put on any other evidence. Now, maybe, you know, another attorney or maybe, I don't know why they didn't, but they did not. And I think the judge had the right to rely on what she felt were the actual needs, based on what the testimony was.
Let me ask you about that NFCU checking account. That clearly, the initial deposit was clearly money that came out of a marital account. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but I have to tell you that they didn't...
Let me follow up then on it.
Yeah.
The trial judge, though, accepted what he said was a stipulation that it was separate property. But I don't see any stipulation whatsoever in the record supporting that.
Your Honor, let me respond. The account was opened at the time of separation. Not only did marital money go into it, but ultimately, during the period of time of the litigation, his post-separation income was in there. There's no evidence in this record that Mrs. Ross asked the court to consider this as marital property. That's why I don't understand why he raised it now. And in fact, if you look at her motion for alternate valuation, she said there were no marital funds remaining.
Why would you ask for an alternative date of separation, an alternative date of valuation if it were separate property?
Well, let me explain. In her motion for alternate valuation, they had all the bank records. I mean, I should explain that. They actually stated there were no marital funds remaining in the account. That was her evidence.
No, her evidence, the bank record clearly shows that money coming from the marital account was opened in an account in the husband's name only.
If you look at her motion for alternate valuation, that's her motion. Actually, it's, I think it's JA101. She states that there were no marital funds in the account. Let me see if I can find it. Now, are we on the NFCU account or the motion for alternate valuation of the $44,000? It was only $16,000 in the NFCU account.
Well, I'm concerned about the judge classifying that as separate property based on a stipulation that doesn't appear to exist.
I don't recall a stipulation. The only thing
that would be error, would it not?
Except for the following. And again, we have to understand that if you look at the bank records, the bank records show his income going into that account after he separated. Now, I guess...
So if that's the case, so let's forget about the stipulation. he puts marital money into an account in his name that, and then accepting your argument that he then has clearly separate money in the account, the marital money is transmuted to marriage or to separate.
Well,
putting on her the obligation to trace it, but she clearly can trace it.
Well, here's the problem, Judge. Our client presented evidence before the court of what happened to the so-called marital money, all of it. $10,000 of it went to pay her legal fees, and he knows that. Counsel's aware of that. He presented evidence that
was
satisfied.
Is that the record, though?
I believe so, yes.
But we never got to that, though, because the judge just said separate property. Per stipulation.
That would be, but if you look at the record.
So wouldn't we have to send this back at least for the trial court to do a ruling to determine whether or not she had traced that money?
Now I'm getting confused with the question, so let me just make sure I understand. The motion for alternate valuation concerned the $44,000. The judge found that he had spent that money satisfactorily. He put in lists. He showed bank accounts, including what he had done with it. Now, the $16,000 that was left, which I think is what you're questioning, at least that's the way he did it in his assignment of error. The $16,000, which is issue number four, I guess. There was no evidence in the record that Mrs. Ross asked the court to consider it marital. In her motion, having looked at everything for evaluation, for alternate evaluation, she states there were no marital funds remaining in the account. But now he brings this up as an issue on appeal. So somehow what he's appealing has to be consistent with what actually he wrote and what was presented as evidence in the record. And it's not. Because there was clear evidence as to what happened to the $44,000. He's challenging the number four, the $16,000, but he never asked for it at trial. I mean, somehow it's kind of like I'm being asked to defend something that I didn't have to defend at trial. But my belief is that the judge very carefully listened to all the evidence. She really did. She was extremely patient. She went through everything. And I believe that if you look at the record, look what he actually states and what he appeals, it's inconsistent. With regard to just quickly that issue of the Brandenburg where she wants credit for her pay down of the mortgage, she was using marital money to do it. The evidence was at trial that he'd been paying her before Pendenny Lighting, and she used that money. So I don't see why the court would have committed error by refusing to give her credit for pay down on the mortgage when she was using money, as far as the evidence that came in was from her husband, a marital source. The issue, his last issue of attacking Dr. Peter's testimony, there was no evidence presented by either of the experts for Mrs. Ross that she couldn't work right now. In fact, they testified that they had people in the same professions with the same illness, or I should say injury, that were working. Dr. Hope, by the way, was an independent medical examiner. We asked for an RME. He was not, quote, some person that we hired to testify on behalf of our client. He did an independent, we filed for it and it was granted. And his take, having thoroughly examined her, was that her issues were, exaggerated, that she seemed to be functioning normally. And while the court didn't consider this, there was a lawsuit, either a claim or a lawsuit on behalf of this accident. So I don't know what was in the minds of her other doctors, but the two that testified said she could work and also said that her symptoms could be, Dr. Fado very clearly said that she functioned normally with memory, and he said her symptoms could be perhaps exacerbated or caused by the fact that she had depression over the separation divorce. This was her own testimony, the testimony of her experts. I felt, having reviewed this case and having reviewed my partner's brief and the transcript, I believe the judge really worked hard on this case. I believe that she actually...
Can I ask you one question on...
Sure.
You noted that on assignment of error 4, you don't believe it was argued below.
No.
And so what of the 6 assignments of error, which would you say are not preserved for appeal?
Number 1. Number 4. Right. Number 2 on the sufficiency of the evidence. I'm sorry, the findings.
So 1, 2, and 4 would be your argument. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to take you off.
No, no, that's okay.
You're running out of time, but I have to ask one additional question. On that checking account, or NFSU account, whatever it's referred to as, you said that there was additional post-separation money put into that account by the husband. Is that correct?
Yes, it's my recall, Judge.
Okay, well, I can only find one page in the appendix pertaining to that account, and that's the statement of from October 26 to November 25.
What
and
year,
that's
Judge?
A joint, that's a JA 1143.
What year, 2016?
I'm sorry. I forget, these things go on for more than 1 year. 2015.
Okay. It is, by the time we got to trial, in other words, whatever was in that account. See, and now we're kind of confusing between...
Well, no. My question is there anything in the appendix other than that one bank statement? Because if there's not, all I'm seeing is 2 deposits to that, $33,949 and $3,000. I'm not seeing any deposits that could be construed as post-separation deposits.
Okay, according to my partner, all of the bank statements are in there.
Are they in the appendix?
Yes.
Can you?
But it's thick, Judge, I'm sure.
Tell me about it.
I'm sorry. But
could you point me to a location? I'm sorry you're having to work in tandem with only one voice.
They're joint statements. They have all the accounts in them.
Okay. Judge, it goes from 1140,
before that.
Limit.
It was all in exhibit.
It was all in the exhibits, and it goes from like 1139 through, oh Lord.
Boop. Starting at 1139 and goes through.
Through 1443.
Okay.
I mean, they started off as joint, and then you'll see the separate.
But those are there any?
They're combined accounts.
Oh, these are combined. But I can only find one page dealing with this account ending in 7700, which is the account I think in question.
No, it's always the first one here.
Maybe Federal Credit Union.
It's the first one.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're just...
Starting at 1241.
1241. All right.
I hate to do this because I hate to do this to the court. It was voluminous evidence
I know it is. I'll look further, but we've exhausted, I think, what we're going to get. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. McDowell, we've extended their argument a little bit. We'll give you a little extra time
Thank
for
you,
rebuttal.
Sir. Yes, sir. All right.
Give you an extra 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, Your Honor, the court is exactly right in this, that the trial court here did not really adhere to this court's Cleary decision in terms of the kinds of findings and specificity that would be necessary to support a defined duration award. This case is...
Well, let's I think the argument on at least the first assignment of error is that was not preserved. Did you raise with the trial court that it did not make an adequate written finding, or did you just object that the evidence didn't support the finding?
Well, Your Honor, certainly my objections to both the initial final order, which is, I believe, March 3rd, as well as the second, have any number of issues. Did the word finding get used? I don't think so, unfortunately. I think determinations was used. The court failed to consider the following evidence was used. But we did have a 19-page motion to reconsider. And in that 19 pages, about six or seven of them are directly on point with the issues regarding the duration and the amount of spousal support. And I would submit, Your Honor, that, as you well know, 5A18 is really designed to give the trial court an opportunity to cure something. And just in that...
To do it timely.
Pardon me? Yes, timely.
To hear
yes.
something okay. timely.
And the court, in its letter opinion, its second letter opinion of... March 21st, which appears at, I don't know. But anyway, it's in the record. The court specifically says that it is addressing the issues in the motion to reconsider, and it is addressing the issues that we took with respect to the amount of, and the court says what it reviewed was or what it considered was Mr. Ross's ability, Mrs. Ross's needs, and then the court goes on to say that the defendant presented no evidence to find employment.
But there's a difference between objecting to the evidence that supports the finding and objecting to the court's failure to make a written finding. Those are two separate objections.
Well, I understand what the court's saying. I know the court's been very specific in this particular statute in making these requirements, but what I would ask the court to consider is that was the court put on notice? I mean, that's really the issue in a 5A18 or a 5A25 issue is, was the court on notice? Not do you say specifically the magic words findings. I would submit that there should be no magic talisman as to exactly the words that need to be used. We use a question of determinations or fails to consider, and so I would submit that the court, especially given that letter opinion, is pretty clear that the court knew that's what we were taking issue with in her decision. And I would ask the court for that basis to find there was no procedural default in this case.
And I think the other issue that was raised by your opponent is the fact that you never claimed that the remaining balance in that Navy Federal Credit Union account that was $16,000,
yes, sir,
was marital property.
We made the motion for alternate valuation. We claimed that the whole $44,000 should be there, but I think in our papers we did claim that that account, well, and certainly even by definition, as the court pointed out earlier, the court has to, by statute, determine what was marital assets and what were separate assets, and that was a marital asset because it had been used as the recipient of all that $44,000 in joint marital assets. That put the burden on them to say why this was separate.
How do you respond to Ms. Renteer's point, though, that you at some point acknowledged that what was in that Navy Federal Credit Union account was not marital, that it was all separate?
I don't think we ever acknowledged that. Whether or not we ever, in the record, affirmatively said, and by the way, Judge, if you don't give us an alternate valuation on the 44, you should at least give us the 16 that's still remaining in the account. But I think it had its marital character, and the court should have recognized that.
Once the money was put in a separate account, it was commingled, if it was commingled with separate property, it transmutes.
Yes.
And takes on the character of the accountant to which it was placed, a separate account. And then the burden is upon you to trace that money to show a portion of it was marital. And that may be the step that got left out of the calculation here.
Yes, perhaps. I took the case law to mean that once, even though it was identified as marital assets, even though it might be in somebody else's separate account, that they had the burden to prove to Congress that it was separate. Just because he put his name on it, I don't think should necessarily put the burden on us. A few other points. The court is exactly.
The question is, if he put his name on it after they separated or before they separated, if they're still married, I mean, if they're still living together as a married couple, and he opens an account and starts putting his paychecks in there, doesn't that make it marital?
Yes.
But if he opens it afterwards and starts putting his paychecks after the separation, doesn't that make it separate?
But this was done before the separation. I think the evidence in both the account statements and in the other evidence in the case will show that. It was done before he separated.
Before, but in anticipation of a very
in anticipation of his leaving. All in that week of November 16th. I think his first movement of money out of the joint account into his separate account was on November 13th, actually. And the date of separation the court found was November 16th. So it was 3 days before the court found that the parties were separate, that account was opened and the first amount of money was put in, the first portion of the $44,000 was put into it. The other point I wanted to make was that with respect to the separate assets, the counsel claims that was marital money that my client was using to pay the mortgage down post-separation while she was remaining living in the house. There's a pending letter consent order that says the $3,500 that had been given to her was to be deemed her spousal support. So the fact that she used her spousal support, that is her own money. If she decided to invest it in something, that is her separate asset post-separation by definition of the statute. So I take issue with counsel's statement on that.
All right. Your rebuttal has expired. The
yes,
case
sir.
Is submitted. Thank you. We will greet counsel.